book of Daniel chapter 5, and of course very, very famous passage, the writing on the wall. And I'm sure if you've been through Sunday school, you were taught this passage, because I never went through Sunday school. I don't know what thoughts go through the mind of children when they get stories like this. But I wonder if you had dreams about this, if your Sunday school teacher was particularly good at communicating, and you had this picture of this palace and all this banqueting, and suddenly a hand appears and writes some words. It's quite a terrifying image, isn't it? And it's a very, very famous passage. I didn't want to just take it all in one hit, because there is so much in it. So what I'm going to be doing this evening is looking at verses 1 to 12. Now, the reason I'm doing a series in Daniel is because I want us to learn this lesson. How do we live a Christian life in this hostile world? You remember, this is what I've been saying every week, that here were Daniel and his colleagues, and they were in Babylon. They weren't in Jerusalem, they weren't in Israel, they weren't in Judah. They were in exile in Babylon, a world, a country that is totally unchristian, non-Christian, idolatrous in all its ways. And here were these men who were faithful to God, and somehow they managed to live a life honoring to God in this sea of hostility and idolatry. And as I've been saying, in a sense, we are like that today. Our nation has gone a long way from the Bible into idolatry and into unbelief, into an unchristian society. And we as the church, we are to seek to maintain a testimony in a world like this. And as we've been going through Daniel, we've been learning various lessons that have helped us. We've looked at how we are to resolve to live a godly life. We saw that in chapter 1. And we've seen lessons about God in this book. And we've seen that how, if we are to live a godly life, we must know who our God is. We must have a very clear picture in our mind of who He is, what is His character. Because these things will equip us to live the Christian life. Now they tell me, I've never been in the army, but they tell me that in the army you are to know two things. You are to know what weaponry you have, and you are to know your enemy. If you are to be successful in warfare, you need to know who your enemy is, what weaponry your enemy has, what positions your enemy has taken up, so that you can then use your weaponry to overcome your enemy. And that, of course, is the same in spiritual warfare. We don't only need to know who our God is and what resources we have at our disposal, but we need to know who the enemy is. In other words, we need to know the characteristics of the world in which we live. The characteristics of the world in which we live. Tomorrow you will be going out into this world. If you're a working person, you'll be rubbing shoulders with people in this world, people who are not Christians. You'll be meeting perhaps family who are not Christians, neighbors who are not Christians, friends who are not Christians. And you will have all kinds of dealings through this week with people who are not Christians. Well, what sort of people are they? What are their characteristics? We at least need to know that so that we can pray for them. We can be on our guard against them. And we may know how to live a godly life in their midst. And this passage, Daniel chapter 5, verses 1 to 12, I don't know if you've ever thought about this. It is a unique passage in the Old Testament. There isn't a passage like this in the whole of the Old Testament. Because in this passage, you have a whole group of idolatrous unbelievers. There isn't an Israelite anywhere until Daniel is summoned. You have a group of Babylonian idolaters banqueting, having a party. It's a little bit like a group of pleasure-seeking, hedonistic non-Christians have gathered somewhere and are having a party, and there's all the drink and whatever people have, drugs, I don't know what people have when they have a party. But if you can imagine a very large group of people have gathered somewhere, and they're not a Christian among them, not a single Christian among them. And they're having a party. They've got all their drinks and all the food and all the drugs and all the music and so on. And it's rather like there are cameras and we are sitting in our home and we are watching this scene taking place of a large group of total unbelievers, idolatrous people, people who have no links with God's people, people who have no links with Jehovah, out there having a banquet, having a party. And that's rare in the Bible. I couldn't find any other passage in the Bible where you have this. Because the Bible essentially, of course, is the history of Israel, God's people. So just about every passage has God's people in it. You know, you have Abraham and you have Isaac and you have Moses and Joshua and David and Solomon. Every passage has Israelites in it. There might be idolatrous Israelites who've gone away from God, but they were Israelites. They were God's people. And God's word at least had a bearing upon them. But here you have this passage of a whole group of total idolatrous people having a banquet. And it is a passage that therefore gives us an insight into what is this world into which God has called us to live a life that is honoring to Him. In John 17, when Jesus prayed for His church, Jesus prayed to the Father and He said, I do not pray that you take them out of this world, but I pray that you protect them while they're in this world. That is what Jesus essentially prayed, that God wouldn't remove us, but that God would protect us so that we are in the world, but we're not of the world. So what is this world like? What are their thought processes? What are their characteristics that we are dealing with? This passage gives us that. Now there are four things that I want to tell you about from this passage. Four things that I want to tell you about the world in which we live, the world to whom we are witnessing. Four things from this passage. The first is this. It is a proud and arrogant world. It is a proud and arrogant world. And the reason I say that is because of what it says in verse 1. Incidentally, the original language is not easy to translate. There are so many phrases and words in this passage, and you will notice in your Bible there are footnotes everywhere because some of these words have not been the easiest to translate. I noticed there wasn't a footnote at verse 1, but I think there should have been. Verse 1 isn't the easiest to translate, and it says there in verse 1, King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. In front of the 1,000. Now that's a phrase that is put in there. It's quite a common phrase that is used in the Bible. And everywhere that it is used in the Bible, it speaks about showing off wealth, showing off how powerful and how wise a person is. It's that kind of phrase. So it wasn't just that, you know, there they were sitting and he sat in front of them and he drank wine in front of them. That's not what we are to read from verse 1. It is a verse that says that this man was filled with pride and with arrogance. And we know that because later when Daniel is summoned and Daniel tells him about one of his ancestors. And Daniel says, you know how one of your ancestors, Nebuchadnezzar, was also proud and arrogant, and God dealt with him. And then Daniel says to him in verse 22, and you, his descendant, actually the word is descendant because he wasn't a son, he was a few steps down the line, and you, his descendant, Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself or not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. You are filled with pride and arrogance. In other words, what they were dealing with is people who were absolutely convinced that they were right. If Daniel and his colleagues had walked into this banquet, if they hadn't been summoned, if there was no writing on the wall, but this banquet was going on, and if Daniel and his colleagues had walked in, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, if they had walked in, and they would have said, if you don't mind, can you give us 10 minutes? We just want to say something to you. And if they had spoken and said, now look, you are all idolatrous. There is a God in heaven, Jehovah, and He is the one true living God, and He has made His ways known, and you should follow His ways. They would immediately have dismissed them and said, you don't know what you're talking about. We know that we are right. We know that the ways we're following are the right ways. We know that the way in which we live our lives is right. And that is the world in which we live. You listen to any radio station, you watch television, and you see some of these people who are expressing opinions on sexuality, gender, marriage, religion, God, revelation, worship, any of these subjects. And it doesn't even occur to them that the position I hold, you know, may be wrong. You know how it is. You speak to one of these people and say, look, you hold this position on sexuality. Or you hold this position on marriage. And you say, well, marriage is an optional thing. If you want to marry your partner, you can marry your partner. If you don't want to marry your partner, you just want to live with them, you can live with them. It's purely an optional extra. Whether your partner is the same sex as you or a different, the opposite sex, well, that's doesn't matter either. This is your choice. And if we turn around and said, do you know you are wrong? The moment you say words like, you are wrong, they look at you as if you've gone mad. Of course I'm not wrong. Of course I'm right. It wouldn't occur to them that actually they are wrong. And the views they are expressing are wrong views. Wouldn't even occur to them that there is such a thing as right and wrong. It's all relative, you see. If you say that, well, of course, for you that might be the case, but I know the truth is, it doesn't matter. There is this pride and this arrogance in the world. It actually makes evangelism very, very difficult. If you have people who are unsure of their position, few people who are seeking, who hold a certain position because they've been taught that, but they're not sure if what I believe is true. And I'd like to hear other positions. And, you know, you tell me your position, I'll think about it. Well, at least you have an inroad then. You can say, well, let's discuss your views then. But if the person says, well, I know what I believe and I know it's true. You see, it's a closed door. And that was the case with the people that Belshazzar had around him, the Babylonians. They were proud and arrogant. And wouldn't occur to them that what they were doing is wrong. If somebody had come and said, this is wrong, this is sinful, wouldn't have occurred to them. They were right as far as they were concerned. So in the first place, it's a proud and arrogant world. The second thing that we see in this passage is that it is a world that will deliberately mock the things of God. We live in a world that will deliberately mock the things of this world. They've gathered in this banquet. And it says in verse 2, Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his ancestor, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Now why? He wasn't short of goblets. It's not as if they'd called all these people and they'd run out of glasses and say, hey, we'd better get some, do you know where you can get glasses? Oh yeah, there are some that my ancestor Nebuchadnezzar brought. It wasn't that. He had enough goblets in his palace to feed everybody. But you see, there is this kind of a deliberate desire to make a statement. My ancestor Nebuchadnezzar, besieged Babylon and defeated Babylon and destroyed the temple that is in Babylon and brought the glasses and these materials from the temple in Babylon. And we want to show that our God is greater than their God. We want to show that our God, the gods whom we worship, have superiority over the gods of these Jews. So these wine goblets that they hold to be holy, well, let's have them and drink from them. And he must have known that they were dedicated to the Lord. There were these ceremonies in the Old Testament, in the law of Moses, whereby they would take a glass and they would say, well, we're going to dedicate the glass to the Lord so that it's only used for the worship of the temple. It's not going to be used for ordinary use. And they must have known that, because that was quite a common practice. So he knew that these glasses had been dedicated, had been set aside as sacred for the use of God. But it's a deliberate mocking of true religion. It's a deliberate mocking of God's people and the true religion that belongs to God. Then they brought in the golden vessels. And you see, again and again, the writer makes this point. They brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood and stone. It's a deliberate mocking of the one true living God. There was a time in this nation when people would say, well, I don't believe, but they wouldn't mock Christianity. There was a time in this nation where in the media, the people would accept that they're not Christians, but they wouldn't mock Christianity. But we have gone a long way from that. And it's very difficult now to watch particularly a comedy program, a stand-up comic, or you know, some, one of these comic programs, because there is a deliberate mocking of Christianity. Christianity is now fair sport to be mocked. And all sorts of programs you will see. And you will have people in this world, and they will deliberately mock the one true living faith and the one true living God. Because that is how the devil works. The devil will have people who at one time respected Christianity. They weren't Christians, but they respected Christianity. And then the devil is at work in them. And in the book of Romans, the Bible talks about how people move from one position to another, to another, to another. And so they move from being unbelievers who respect Christianity to unbelievers who leave Christianity and leave Christians to themselves, to unbelievers who are now hostile to Christianity, to unbelievers who are now mocking Christianity. And you know how it is. You watch TV programs, you listen to radio programs, and there is this mocking of the Christian faith. I don't want to use real examples because it is blasphemy. But there is a mocking of the Christian faith. It is the world we live in. And again, it makes evangelism very difficult. We have to accept this. To speak to unbelievers who are proud and arrogant and confident in what they believe and actually mocking Christianity, to actually speak is very difficult. And we need courage from God. We need to be prayerful that God will give us courage. The third thing that this passage teaches us about the world in which we live, it's proud and arrogant. It deliberately mocks the things of God. And thirdly, it is an idolatrous world. It is an idolatrous world. I've just read verse 4. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood and stone. Now, you don't have to have gods made of iron, wood and stone in order to be an idolater. You only have to have something that you value more than the one true living God to be an idolater. And anybody who is not a born-again Christian, not an evangelical Christian, who has come to love and trust the one true living God through Jesus Christ, is an idolater. Because we are made for worship. We are made to seek pleasure and fulfillment and satisfaction in something outside of us. That is in our DNA. That's what we are hardwired to. That's our default setting. We will look for something in which to trust for comfort, for fulfillment, for joy. And the world looks for, well, it looks to money, it looks to possessions, it looks to position, it looks to power, it looks to all kinds of things. And the world will seek after this, and the world will run after this. And the world will want anything but what is the one true living God. I was visiting my family yesterday, and they're all Hindus, and my mother has this book that her Hindu priest has put together, and he has pulled quotes from all over the place, from Buddha and from the Hindu scriptures and philosophers and so on, and he's pulled up one line or one sentence quotes and put together a booklet so that a person can read a sentence and meditate on it. And my mom was showing me this booklet, and she said, my Hindu priest for this 2020, he's put together this booklet, have a look at it. And I didn't really want to look at it, it's just full of idolatry. But I flicked through it, and to my astonishment, I came to this sentence. It was a day in March, and thought for the day in March. What will it profit a man if he should seek the whole world and yet lose his soul? And I read that, and I said to my mom, this is interesting, have you read this? And she said, oh, it's not till March, I'll come to it. And I said, any idea, because he didn't put down who said the words, the priest. And I said, any idea who said this? And she said, oh, it's probably in our scriptures or in Buddhism. And I said, Jesus said those words, they're in the Bible. And he's talking about idolatry. Because Jesus said, what will it profit a man if you gain the whole world? You make the whole world your idol. But you lose your soul. But that is what the world is willing to do. You see, the world is willing to get into this trade. Give us the possessions of the world. The possessions of the world will give us pleasure, fulfillment, and joy, and comfort. And you can have your God. And this was an idolatrous world in which they lived. And then fourthly and finally, the world in which we live, the world in which they lived. And it has this characteristic. It does not learn from history. It does not learn from history. Next time I'm in this pulpit, we'll be looking at the rest. What was that? Was that somebody's phone? Sorry. I'm not carrying my phone, so it can't be me. The next time I'm in the pulpit, we'll be looking at the rest of chapter 5. But you notice how Daniel speaks to Belshazzar. And Daniel reminds Belshazzar of what had happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And he says in verse 20, his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened, so that he dealt proudly. He's talking about Nebuchadnezzar. And he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. And then he says to Belshazzar in verse 22, and you, his descendant, Belshazzar, you've not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. You knew the history of your ancestor. Because, of course, Nebuchadnezzar had written it down. Do you remember when we were looking at chapter 4, when Nebuchadnezzar wrote these experiences? It was Nebuchadnezzar who wrote it. Nebuchadnezzar wrote Daniel chapter 4. Daniel didn't write it. Nebuchadnezzar wrote Daniel chapter 4. And Nebuchadnezzar wrote about how he had become proud and arrogant, and how God had warned him. And when he gave way to his pride, how God had brought him down, and how he had lived like a beast of the fields and ate grass. And then his right mind returned to him. Nebuchadnezzar wrote all of this. And it must have been there in the writings of the Babylonians, because Daniel refers to it. And Daniel says to him, you, his son, or his descendant, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. I honestly find this one of the most astonishing things about the Western world, particularly about Britain. Maybe it's because I'm a historian. I did a degree in history. And I was taught from day one, you learn from history. Every professor who stood before me would make this point. Why are you here? Why am I here? Why am I teaching you history? Because history has lessons to teach us. And you must learn the lessons of history. Don't ignore the lessons of history. History is the most important teacher you have. Every professor would tell us this. And they really hammered it into us. The history of this nation, the history of the other nations. Learn the lessons. And this nation, probably of all the nations in the world, I haven't given this great thought, so I'm not going to say definitely, but probably of all the nations in the world, this nation has had tremendous blessings from God, and Christianity and the Bible has been in the DNA of this nation for centuries. I'm not saying every person in this nation has been a Christian. That's never been the case. But if you go back to the Victorian times and from that time onwards, it's quite clear that the Bible has been in the DNA of this nation. Because God has visited this nation and God has poured out His Spirit and people have become Christians and they've lived Christian lives and there have been people of influence. And so all sorts of laws have been passed and people have lived in certain ways. Why is it that the marriage state was so honored in this nation? Heterosexual marriage. How come it was so honored in this nation? Do you know there are very few nations in the world where heterosexual marriage or monogamous marriage is honored like it has been in this nation? In Kenya, if you said, we're going to be monogamous, well, actually, the MPs passed a law saying polygamy is now legal in Kenya. This was happening just as we were leaving the country. And Christians made a stand against it, and the law went through. Because just about every MP was in favor, because they were all polygamous. And in India, if you talk about marriage in the way that we talk about marriage in this country, or we used to talk about marriage in this country, according to biblical standards, that although the man is the head of the house, it is a marriage of equals, and there is to be love and there is to be honor. Well, of course, the Indians know nothing of this. But all these wonderful Christian values that are in the Bible, marriage, family life, lifelong marriage, and parents loving each other, and parents loving their children, and bringing up their children, and teaching the scriptures to their children, and seeking to make the word of God known to them, and sending their children to Sunday school so that they at least learn the scriptures. The Bible was in the DNA of this nation. And that's what made this nation great. It made this nation what it was. And today, people, historians, ignore Christian history. They behave as if this nation has always been as it is, with care for the elderly and care for the sick and so on, without Christianity. You know, this is how we evolved. We British are just naturally kind people who have always been kind, considerate, compassionate people. It's Christianity that brought in kindness and compassion in this country. It is Christianity that influenced this nation. The nation won't learn from this. And you speak to historians and they say, don't you understand the influence the Bible has had and Christianity has had? And actually they'll tell you, well, those have been negative influences. And we've moved on from there. But the fact that we have the kind of society we do, it's fast going, but the kind of society we do is down to the Christian faith. But the world will not learn from history. I don't want to depress you unnecessarily, but it is important for us to understand the world in which we live. And that is the world in which we live. But the encouraging thing is, Daniel and his colleagues had an influence. And God was at work in this world. And we need to pray that God will help us to be faithful and that He would be at work in the world in which we live today. But that is the lessons, or those are the lessons we learn about the world in which we live. Let's come.